It's 4:06. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at the amount of debt that's been reported in collections in the United States and see what that's doing to our country.
First, the Department of Natural Resources is deciding how to set its priorities when it comes to restoring the health of Wisconsin's water over the next 3 years.
They're turning to the public for input, hoping to get perspective on what the most pressing issues are.
Ashley Bronick is Water Resource Specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So every 3 years, the DNR reviews the water quality criteria. What kind of things are on the table this time around?
So this time around, we have a list of topics that we got from the EPA, from DNR staff, from the public. They include things like cyanobacteria toxins, chlorides, pesticides, insecticides, and wild rice, for example.
And this is something we do every 3 years, right?
Yeah, this is something we do every 3 years. It is required by the Clean Water Act. Every state needs to do this.
And what do you want to hear now from the public when it comes to their input on water quality?
So we have a public survey that is on our website at dnr.wi.gov. And if you search for standards review, you should find it. It is essentially, we have 22 topics that you guys submitted, and we would like you to rank your top three. We also have the opportunity tomorrow for you to comment at a public hearing from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., and you can join us online from a link on our website, or you can come in person to the downtown DNR office.
And hearing some of the topics, like cyanobacteria was one of them.
Yes.
Now, I might think, well, I'm not going to go and, vote on these things. I don't know what that is. But there's a little more than that on the actual survey.
Yes.
What do you give us when we go there to check
it
out?
So when you go to the webpage, you're going to find a link for topic descriptions. It's a document that it has the topic and it has a description of what exactly it is. So you'll know what you're voting on.
And you might go through and think, well, all these things are important. Do them all. Why can't you just do them all?
Oh, we would love to do them all, but we only have so many, there's only so many hours in the day, so many staff, and so much funding. So we want to prioritize so that we can get the most important, the most pressing things done first.
And I imagine the DNR has some of the science down here already, and the EPA as well. The public input is trying to, I guess, try to gauge how these things are affecting our lives, if I live on a lake or I'm worried about the water in my city or what have you.
Right. So if you live on a lake where there's a lot of blue-green algae, you might be concerned about toxins, or maybe you're concerned about wild rice preservation, or you want to conserve wetlands. There are topics related to all of those on this list.
I want to get into a few of those a little more, but what once the public has done these surveys, and when are those due by again?
That is due by August 7th.
Okay, so if people want to fill out their survey, do it by August 7th. So after August 7th, you've got all these public surveys. How do you factor that into DNR decision-making?
So we're going to go through and see what the public ranked the highest. We're going to take that input. We have input from our DNR staff and technical partners, and we're going to come up with a finalized list of priorities.
And what do you do with those priorities? Mean you're going to study those or take steps on those? What's the next step once something is a top priority?
So for some of them, we do still need to do some of the research. And if it's a top priority for us, that'll help us allocate funds to do the studies. Or it could include rulemaking or guidance drafting. And if there are any changes in rules, we'll have another public hearing at a later date so that people can have input at that time as well.
Well, I want to talk about a few of the concerns that are options on this survey. And by selecting them, I don't want to push people toward voting for them. But cyanobacteria, what is that? What are some of the bacteria problems in our waterways?
So in some cases where there are high nutrients, we can get blue-green algae blooms. And some of them, not all of them, have toxins. And those toxins can be harmful to pets. If it's really high concentrations, it can be harmful to people while they're swimming. So we want to protect the uses of a water body. If people are fishing there or if they're swimming there, we want them to be to use these resources to be healthy.
And that's a fairly common cause, I would imagine, of a no swim zone posting on a beach would be that kind of bacteria. Okay. And nutrients you mentioned as a cause of blue-green algae, I think that's a separate category all its own. I think nitrogen?
Yep, nitrogen is one of the ones on the list. We have criteria for phosphorus already. Mm-hmm. Nitrogen is the next step that the EPA would like us to take.
And is that phosphorus and nitrogen, is that an urban thing or agricultural runoff, a little of both?
A little bit of both, yeah. We need to regulate both, essentially, to help keep our waters clean.
And we saw and talked about a report not too long ago from a national environmental group, the National Resources Defense Council, giving a bad rating to our beaches here in Wisconsin. I think this is mostly along the Great Lakes, mm-hmm. Eighth worst in states with a coast on an ocean or a Great Lake. Why do we rank poorly? Are some of the things we're talking about here a factor there?
Some of the things we are working on actually will hopefully address our beaches. One of the things we're working on, people won't have to rank this one, we're working on a bacteria water quality criteria for our beaches. We're also working, one of the things on the list is cladophora, which is a green algae that can create mats on the beach, and it's not really pleasant to be around, and it can smell when it decays. So that's one of the things that's on the list, and I think that's one of the reasons our beaches were rated so poorly.
And you mentioned wild rice. I don't really think it, when I thought of the freshwater quality issues, I thought lakes, streams, rivers. How did wild rice fit into the equation?
So one of the things on the list is to protect wild rice habitat. So we don't have any specific criteria to protect our wild rice beds. And one of the topics is to create something so we'll have criteria so that wild rice is protected in the future.
So how important is it for the DNR with this kind of survey and in general through the course of a year or a three-year period to get input from the public when it comes to water quality issues?
We really would like public input. I really encourage everyone to take the survey and give their input. We need to know what people would like us to work on. We need to know what's important to everyone because these are our waters and people of Wisconsin use them.
And looking to the past a little bit, you mentioned that we already have guidelines in place for phosphorus. You know, was it the case that 3 or 6 or 9 years ago, phosphorus was a selection in a survey? Or might that have been the process that led to that?
That might have been the process. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure on that one, but I can see that on a list of things that people could comment on in the past.
And then once we've got all this in place, you've got the priorities, you start putting an action plan in, is the EPA still part of the discussion? Do they have to look over your shoulder and see what we're doing here in the state to tackle these problems?
We do have some input from the EPA. Like they did submit some topics for us to think about. They will get a copy of this final report. So they're a part of the process, but we're doing our work to help Wisconsin waters.
And you've got the survey on the DNR website. You've got the hearing tomorrow in Madison at the Capitol, is it?
It's actually at the DNR building at 10 a.m.
Okay. And then for the rest of the year, what's a good way for people to reach out and contact the DNR, people like you, about water quality if they're worried about what's in their town and their backyard?
Sure. You can search on the DNR website, and there are public contacts usually on any number of topics, like if blue-green algae. I know if you go on the website, there is a contact person at the bottom. You can email them or give them a call.
All right. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Ashley Baranek. She's a water resource specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. And by the way, again, the DNR is hosting that public hearing on water quality standards tomorrow at 10. Find more info at the DNR website.
It's no secret that personal debt in America remains a major problem even after the end of the Great Recession. But a new report out today puts some perspective on just how many people are struggling with long-term debt and the consequences it's having.
According to a report from the Urban Institute, more than 35% of Americans have debts and unpaid bills that have been reported to collection agencies, meaning the debt is past due and the account has been closed and placed in collections. What's at the root of that problem? How do we go about addressing it?
Joining us now is Lynette Kalfani-Cox. She's the CEO of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She's also a former financial news journalist and author of several money management books, including Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. Lynette, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program.
So we have a story today about 77 million Americans have debt that's gone to collections. Does this surprise you?
You know, actually, it doesn't surprise me at all, as sad and pathetic and as traumatic as that might be to hear and as it is for me to say. But I know firsthand from personal experience the sort of widespread nature of debt, how easily it is for Americans to fall in debt. I was in debt myself. I've been very open and honest about sharing my own story. But also, frankly, I've seen many, many studies that sort of hone in on this problem, that we're over-leveraged, that we've just got too much debt. This one, I think, was very pointed in talking about collections and the extent to which people have fallen, you know, very severely behind on their debts because, of course, for many collections accounts, they don't hit that status until they're about 6 months behind their payment due dates. But frankly, again, it's sad to say, no, the numbers didn't surprise me at all.
Well, let's talk about terminology. Collections would be when the person that you owe money to goes to a third party who tries to collect from you. And it gets a little more serious in terms of your credit score, I think.
Well, you know, I've seen some reports about this, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions. So let's kind of clarify for your audience exactly what it means to be in collections. Yes, you can have an account that's past due, let's say a credit card bill, or maybe you even had a newspaper or magazine subscription and you just didn't pay it. It can be turned over to a third party, an outside collection agency. That's the typical, I think, idea that most people have of an account being in collections. But many creditors also have in-house collection agents as well, their own staff that will try to collect the debt. And it doesn't, you know, they won't wait until you're 6 months past due. You can have something ding your credit, as you just alluded to, as early as 30 days when you're past due. So under the law, a creditor can report you to any of the big three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, or TransUnion, when you're just 30 days past due. So it doesn't have to be that the debt is 6 months past due. It doesn't have to have gone to an outside collection agent in order for it to really hamper your credit rating.
Do we know how much debt that these 77 million Americans have in collections?
Yeah, I think that the Urban Institute report talked about the debts that were, you know, somewhere along the lines of 5,200 being the sort of average that the typical adult owes. Now, you know, the numbers are skewed, of course, when you start talking about people who have a mortgage and those who don't have a mortgage. But these were of those 77 million Americans who were reported to be in collections with one or more debts. Those adults owed about just under $5,200. Now, again, this was non-mortgage debt. So, and even then, some debts aren't accounted for. We know the foreclosure crisis that we've been through, where we had, you know, so many tens of millions of Americans who couldn't afford their house notes, and many of them lost their homes as a result of that. But this study in particular looked at things like a medical bill that was past due, utility bills, credit card balances, things of that nature. And frankly, I think that the numbers are probably a little underreported because there are some other things that aren't even tallied. For instance, there's a huge number of very cash-strapped consumers out there who take on personal loans like payday loans, unfortunately very high-cost exorbitant loans, car title loans, et cetera. And then there's also a group of, you know, unbanked consumers, tens of millions of those who have lots of personal debts, again, high-cost debt that's outstanding, and that's not accounted for either.
So, again, a lot of people carry debt, but this is debt that people haven't been able to make payments on in time.
Right. And, you know, again, think about it. Sometimes I think when people see studies like this, that they might say, well, you know, some of this was from, you know, a library bill. It could have been even something that was past due or an overdue account that was $100 balance. The thing to remember about someone who's financially distressed is that every debt adds exponentially to their financial woes. So it's all relative in the sense that you might have someone who's making, say, you know, $35,000 or $40,000, but if that person has, you know, $8,000 in credit card bills, you know, a $2,500 medical bill they're dealing with, utility bills that are past due, and other accounts that are either in collections or sort of on the verge of going into collections because they're so far past due, each one of those is an additional stressor. And so it becomes a point where people are trying to prioritize, like, okay, well, what do I pay first? Or can I even pay? Do I have enough cash flow to be able to at least make the minimums or to keep the basics that I need, keep the lights on, keep my car so it doesn't get repossessed, keep the roof over my head, that kind of thing.
So for these 1 in 3 Americans who do have debt that's gone to collections, what is the impact there? What happens?
The impact on your credit rating can be horrendous. So I'm always talking to people about the financial and the non-financial impact of having excessive debt. In many ways, I think it's actually easier for people to grasp some of the financial consequences. Okay, you might have late payments on your credit report. That means that when you're ready or once you try to get a loan later, a mortgage, a car loan, a student loan, a credit card, then you're going to pay higher interest rates for those forms of credit, and you certainly won't get the best rates and loan terms that are available in the marketplace. Another financial consequence of having excessive debt that winds up marring your credit rating is that it can impact your job. According to SHRM, the Society for Human Resources Management, almost 60% of employers do some form of credit-based employment screening. So they're checking the credit reports of either some or all of new candidates who are, you know, hoping to be hired. Bad credit can also impact people who are trying to get better auto insurance rates. So, you know, that's another financial impact. So, again, we can put some of that in financial terms and think about the numbers there. But really, again, having lived through debt, I can assure your audience that some of the most heinous and really the most insidious part of living with debt is the personal toll that it takes on you and the ramifications throughout your life. So that, you know, the person who is right now indebted with, you know, excessive student loan debt will find it hard to find a mate. I've written recently about how college debt, for example, is sort of the anti-dowry now, that people just don't want to date or get married to someone who has a lot of debt. But even if you're already married or even if you're single, it really doesn't matter. The excessive debt is going to be a personal stressor. It's going to give you headaches, sleepless nights, give you that worrying, you know, feeling in the pit of your stomach, almost like you're getting an ulcer. People with debt tend to have higher absentee rates on the job and more tardiness, more distractions, and accident prone at work, more arguments with their spouses about financial matters and other things. So the ramifications that are so widespread for your career, for your personal life, for your, you know, your marriage, those I don't even think we can put a dollar figure on.
Oh, that's interesting. So if you have some of this debt that goes to collections, you weren't able to avoid the debt in the first place for whatever reason, is it possible for someone to approach the agency and have that stricken from the record?
It is possible to negotiate with your creditors, either if the debt is still owned by the creditor that you originally owed, or even to negotiate with a third-party collection agent. You have to be careful about how you do it. And you have to know what some of your rights are, because frankly, there's a lot of debt collectors who violate the law, and in particular, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So there is something, first of all, called in the industry sort of lingo is called a PFD, or a pay for deletion. And essentially, it means that you might approach a creditor and say, listen, I know I was behind on this bill, you know, maybe I was 6 months behind. You explain the situation. Maybe you had a job loss. Maybe you went through a divorce. Maybe there were high medical bills in the family, whatever the situation was. But if you've rebounded to a certain extent or if you've kind of fixed the financial problem, you might approach that creditor with a lump sum payment or with a payment plan. And what I would do is to request something in writing saying, if I pay X amount of dollars, will you agree to delete from my credit reports all negative information pertaining to this debt? And if you can get a creditor to say yes, then you write that up. You know, I would fax it over to them or mail it, certified mail, get a signature of agreement, and then make the payment. Some people negotiate up front, and a debt collector will say, "Oh yeah, we'll delete that from your credit reports," and then the deletion never happens.
Gotcha. Make sure to get it in writing, certified letter, and the whole deal. We're talking right now with Lynette Kalfani Cox about debt and debt and collections in the United States, and you can join us at 800-642-1234.
Are you one of the tens of millions of Americans who has some sort of debt in the collection process? Are you trying to tackle it, or is it just not possible? And how has debt hurt you in other parts of your life? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with financial expert Lynette Kalfani Cox about a new report out today that looks at the amount of debt Americans have in collections.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have debt collectors coming after you? How does it affect your life financially and otherwise? How are you trying to pull yourself out? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we've got a lot of folks waiting to talk with Lynette, so we're going to go right to the callers and take Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
Just fine, thanks.
So my thing is this. So my ex-wife's house, her mortgage was bought out by another mortgage company. And when they purchased a countrywide mortgage and was bought out by Bank of America, somehow the house ended up back in my name. Hmm. And so I was applying for home loans for myself, and they said, "No, we can't give you a home loan because you already owe $70,000 on your previous house." And I said, "Well, I haven't owned that in 10 years. But so the long story short is it's taken me about 8 months or so to get my credit cleared up. It's been an incredible chore. In fact, for one of the credit bureaus, I had to purchase a copy of my credit report from them in order to be able to argue the fact that their credit report was wrong. And that took months in itself. So as much as a lot of people have debt, even if the debt isn't yours, and trying to get your debt cleared up is such an incredible chore that it's almost unfathomable.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Sounds like a long and winding road there for Mike, who was eventually able to prevail and get the debt cleared from his name. But Lynette, did he approach that the right way?
It sounds like he did. Unfortunately, it was terribly arduous in the process. But, one of the things that I try to tell some, of people that I coach and people who come to my workshops is you have to be super careful about any obligation you have with someone else, certainly someone who's not your spouse, but even someone who is a spouse, because in the event of divorce, even the death of that spouse, many creditors do kooky things, sometimes not always legal, sometimes not always right, but nonetheless, you really can wind up in a kind of thorny situation. In any case like that, what I would suggest to someone is that if you divorce, as soon as possible, certainly get an agreement with your ex-spouse to say who should pay what. However, you need to recognize that whatever happens in divorce court has absolutely no bearing on your legal liability for paying a pre-existing obligation. You know, he said that the mortgage somehow wound up back in his name somehow. From the creditor or lender's perspective, if at the time of his marriage they were both on the mortgage, that was pretty much it in their eyes, which is why they probably tried to come after him for the debt. Glad to hear he got to clear it up in any event.
Okay, interesting. Thank you, Mike. And on to Marie in Central Wisconsin. Hi there.
Hi. I do have a question for Lynette, or a couple comments on the program. I was told that my voice isn't coming through very clearly. Can you hear me all right?
Yep, you're just fine.
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, good. I am a single parent. I am in my close to mid-40s, attractive, intelligent, in good shape, work hard, but I will be poor for the rest of my life. And my one comment was on the comment of marriage or finding a spouse, I will never be able to find a spouse of the quality I'm looking for due to my debt status. And I blame in large part the court system, which perpetuates a true racket with court-ordered services that keep a woman in particular, the most poor. So while the spouse who might have been the larger earner before, or in this case non-marital other parents, they are the larger wage earners, being men. I was already put in a lower economic status just being on my own raising my child. And then when you start dealing in particular with the court system or any past that you may have had or trying to meet your child's needs with medical, education, putting food on the table, we live very simply. There is no way to get out from underneath what I have been put into, which is a true living nightmare. I will be working until I'm falling over dead someday, and I will still not have addressed all of my debt. I'm going back to court again very soon, and I will be enlisted with more court-ordered services. I really would like that addressed for single women, especially in Wisconsin today, because I know this is a huge problem. We can never crawl out from under it. It is very different from what men experience.
Let me jump in there quickly. Are you referring specifically to, like, child support that was not?
Well, I think that's probably always a struggle for people, getting the support that was ordered. But no, I'm talking about things like the counselors that are ordered, the co-parenting people that are ordered, the mediation that is ordered, and all of these extra services of which you pay all or part of the cost. And
right.
If you don't pay it, you're going to be reported. And I do have a huge amount of debt just related even to that aspect. You might have a guardian ad litem who will put you in the hole for years with, you know, that person's services.
All right. Thank you, Marie. Appreciate your calling and sharing your story with us. And Lynette, not having all the particulars, what sort of general advice could you give?
Well, I can kind of weigh in on that because I previously went through a divorce. I was married for 13 years. I divorced in 2005-ish or maybe 2006. I remarried, thank God, and happily remarried. But I was in the rare breed of women who actually pay child support. I paid to my ex-spouse. And by happenstance, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but August is actually Child Support Awareness Month. And I'm keenly aware of both as a payer, because I used to pay child support, spousal maintenance, et cetera. When I was a child, my parents divorced, and my dad did not pay child support as he was ordered to do. So I've been on both sides of this, as a child, being a child in a single parent household where my mother struggled, and then when I was obviously much better off, and I was the primary wage earner in my family when I was previously married and I had to pay child support. I think she's very right that the court system, when you go through divorce and separation and there are children involved, et cetera, it's extremely costly. And many women don't get the child support that they need and a whole bunch of other resources. But 15% of all people who are paying child support are women. And the average child support payment in the country right now is only about just over $430 or so. But over a third of them never receive a dime, a third of custodial parents who are supposed to get the support that's legally due them. They don't get it, even if they have that court order. So I think there needs to be a lot done because there's no national guidelines. There's a whole bunch of problems on that. And, you know, the legal matters alone can very much drive you into debt. And things like child support, it's not dischargeable by bankruptcy, even if you're just totally dead broke and deep in debt, as we've been talking about.
And Lynette, in our last 30 seconds here, is there a solution here for people in order to slow down this trend?
I think mainly it's about knowing your rights. Certainly, you should know your rights under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act that I mentioned earlier. In a nutshell, if someone is a debt collector and contacts you, you have the right to ask them to, A, verify or validate the debt. It's a certain section of the FDCPA that gives you this right. So ask them for proof, you know, first proof that the company actually owns the debt or has been assigned the debt. Ask for a copy of that original signed agreement or credit application, and then ask for your complete payment history, the records, starting with the original creditor. Bottom line, if a debt collector does not give you that information, they're not allowed to report you to the credit bureaus. They can't threaten you with, you know, that they'll seize your property or try to arrest you or, you know, make
and
all these things.
I'm sorry, we have
so
to leave it there.
Right.
Thank you so much, Lynette. We're out of time, but I appreciate you joining us so much. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Lynette Kalfani-Cox is the CEO of AskTheMoneyCoach.com.
NPR has a new boss. The organization's board announced the hire of Jarl Mohn a couple months ago. Mohn has had a long career as in the role of a commercial media executive.
To kick off the new job, Mohn is visiting state and local public radio stations around the country. He was in Wisconsin earlier today and joined us for a look at his vision for NPR. Jarl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, tell us, why did you decide that you wanted to take up the post as president and CEO of NPR?
Well, I've been involved with public radio in Southern California for the last 12 years as a board member and a donor and as chairman of the board. And the early part of my career, my first 19 years in business were in the radio business and commercial radio. And being involved with public radio really kind of rekindled my interest and my love for the medium. I think it's the most powerful, most personal medium that there is. And the opportunity came up, and I kind of had a sense of what the challenges are in this particular role and felt very strongly that I could make a difference here.
Now, you're going to be the eighth CEO or interim CEO of NPR in the last 8 years. Why do you reckon there's so much turnover at the top, and do you see yourself sticking around a bit longer?
Well, I'm definitely sticking around. I made a commitment. I made a legal commitment. I signed a piece of paper, a document, a contract, committing to 5 years minimum in this role. I think there has been turnover. I think there have been a number of reasons. I don't think there's any one common theme. I'm basically a business guy. I'm a radio person, and the organization really has not had a radio person running it for a long period of time. I've been involved on the local level, so I think I have a sense of what the key issues are, and I have a very strong point of view about what I think needs to be done. So I think I'll be around for a while. I told them I'll stay longer if they make it fun, but at least five, at least five.
Well, you referenced a lot of time in for-profit organizations. E! Entertainment Network is one, MTV, VH1 at the leadership levels of those organizations. You've also said that public radio is like coming back to a first love in a way. And you come at a time when NPR's revenues are down by 3%. And I wonder if you think that business experience in the for-profit world is going to inform the way you raise revenue or try to raise revenue at NPR.
Absolutely. I think there has been in public media in general, all across the board, and at NPR specifically, kind of an aversion to the business side of it. It's like, well, you know, if we just do really great work, the money's just – it's going to magically appear. And I think for a long time that was true, but it's not true anymore. So we really have to be good business people. But in doing that, we'll raise the money so that content producers, on-air talent, news people, programmers can have the tools and the resources to do their best work. And that's what I want to do.
And you mentioned you have strong feelings about what needs to happen at NPR. Are there lessons from your work in the commercial realm on the operational side and the content side that NPR could learn from?
Well, there probably are. Because I am a programmer and I have ideas. Listen, anybody that listens to public radio or anybody that listens to or watches any media has strong opinions about what they think is good or not good. I made my living doing that. But I don't think that's where the real success that we're going to have is going to come from, because there are a lot of really bright people that have done great work on the regional level, state level, city level, and at NPR. There's not an absence of ideas. There's an absence of money. So I'm focusing on that part of it because that's where I can make the biggest difference.
You're focusing on money. You've also spent a lot of time at Southern California Public Radio and on the board there. And Southern California Public Radio, it has a slightly more entertainment-y feel. It's got Sandra Singh Lo helming a couple shows. They're developing a new entertainment show, I gather, that's going to have a live component. And I wonder if you think there's anything there that translates to the rest of public radio, which has been caricatured on Saturday Night Live and elsewhere as being kind of stodgy, little stuffy.
Well, the station does have some of those elements. The arts and entertainment show is not on the air yet. But first, to frame it, it is a very serious journalistic organization. It is the largest newsroom behind the LA Times in Southern California, ahead of the television stations. In terms of radio coverage, each year, and this has happened for the last 9 years, maybe 10, KPCC has won more radio awards for news coverage than all the other radio stations in Los Angeles combined. So it is serious. I want to make sure we stress that. That, I think, is the underpinning of what National Public Radio, NPR, should be. Should we have things that are a bit more interesting and entertaining? Absolutely. I think being a bit quirky is part of what public radio is. And a lot of the shows that are on the weekends have those elements. And I think we need more of that, not at the expense of good journalism. I think a lot of people, there was this fear. The good news is it didn't come up very much at all, but the fear, because I ran MTV and VH1 and E, that's the direction we were going in, and it's not. And I always point to what we did at KPCC and said, look, you're not going to see any of that there. I also was chair of Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC for 8 years. So, you know, that's the backbone of what we're going to do.
You've done a lot of work in the digital media realm. How is NPR doing on the off-broadcast side, and what innovations could be out there in the next couple of years?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that, a lot of institutions and content providers are doing. The most important thing we can do, any question we have, any decision we have to make, we have to think about our listener, our user, and what they're experiencing and what platforms are they using, whether it's, the desktop, a laptop, whether it's mobile, whether it's an iPad, whether it's a smartphone. And we have to make all of the content that we produce available to our audience wherever they're going to be. And I think NPR has done a very good job, actually, of pioneering in a lot of areas, NPR One just launching. So I think that you're going to see a lot more initiatives there, but not at the expense of radio. There have been people at NPR in the past, or probably some there now, that look kind of down on radio, that it's a dying medium. I don't believe that to be the case at all. It may not be growing at a rapid clip, but radio, I think, and I've stated it at trade meetings, the R in NPR stands for radio. And it's going to be, it's our past, it's our present, and it will be for a long, long time our future.
In terms of innovations, when you look down the road at the next 5 years, what big innovations can people expect to see from NPR?
Wow. I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't. I'm going to raise the money so that these really bright people that are in the system, whether it's in individual cities, regional, state, or at NPR, have the tools and the resources that they can create those innovations. Those ideas aren't going to come from me. I just want to make sure I create the environment that can happen.
Well, let me follow up on that. At the end of your 5 years, mm-hmm. where would you like to see NPR positioned?
Yeah, what does success look like?
What does success look like? I think public radio is incredibly important and incredibly relevant today already. I think it's been, the cumulative, and of course here at WPR, you've done it longer than almost anybody, right? Mm-hmm. I think fast forwarding 5 years, public radio and NPR are going to be even more relevant and more important. When you look at what's happened in news, across the board, not radio news, but just all news, it's become newspapers as printed form have really become a battered, really kind of traumatized business. They've cut back the newsrooms. Broadcast television has become, in an effort to get ratings, has become very exploitative. It's been the latest crime. It's been a fire. It's been in L.A., the car chase. You put a car chase on TV in L.A., you got ratings. There's that. Cable television news has become, although I hesitate to use the word news, has become ideological. Whether you're on the left or the right, there are channels for you. And then you have, CNN, which has decided to take a more exploitative approach recently. What that's done, I think, is let public radio and NPR kind of in the center, owning fact-based journalism. That's a great place to be. And I think it becomes more and more important as time goes on. And the other piece, which is an emotional piece, I talked about it briefly at the little staff meeting this morning. It used to be in commercial radio in the 60s, 70s. Didn't matter what format you listened to on the radio, whether it was country or top 40. every radio station in every big market, small or large, had this great emotional connection with the listener. That's gone away, I think, in a lot of cases. It hasn't for public radio. So I think this medium, if we continue to do our jobs well and tell great stories, tell important stories really well, is in 5 years more powerful, more relevant, and more a part of people's lives.
One stereotype of NPR and public radio in general, fair or not, is that it's an elitist institution. It's bringing the news you're talking about to a select audience. How do we bridge the gap to bring the news coverage, the journalism you're talking about, to everybody?
Great. It's a great question, and I think it's already happening when we look at some of the newer developments in public radio. And the example I think is the best exemplifies what the future of storytelling is, of important stories, is Planet Money and the series that was done on subprime mortgages. They did 2 one-hour shows taking a topic that was critically important, really, really important, but really hard to talk about. Most people, you couldn't get them to listen to a 2-minute piece on subprime mortgages, you know, CDOs and CLOs and tranches of debt. And who wants to hear that? Planet Money made it very personal. And they built the story from the guy that got the loan that shouldn't have to the loan officer that sold it to him, to the bank that it got sold to, all the way up through the hedge funds. And it took a story that everybody needed to know about and told it in a really engaging way. So I believe that that's the future of and I think we're already taking steps to be different from this elitist, you know, point of view about what is news and how it should be told.
You've been on a tour of sorts, visiting public radio stations that don't normally get a visit from an NPR president. And by the way, thank you for that.
Sure.
It's wonderful to have you here. What kind of sense have you gotten as you toured and you've visited these little public radio stations, some big, some little? What do you have a sense of the organization as a whole at this point?
It's been fabulous. First, I've never felt as warmly welcomed in anything I've done in my career, every single stop along the way, and including at headquarters at NPR. That's been, on a personal level, very gratifying. The other thing that's been really encouraging, and I shouldn't say I'm surprised by it. I'm not. No matter how small a town I roll into, the level of commitment to public radio, to serving the communities, is incredibly strong. And really bright, creative, deeply engaged people working, in some cases, with very little in the way of resources to help their community become more aware.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is fun.
That was NPR's new CEO and president, Jarl Mohn.